Good evening, everybody. It's Zach here from the People of Color podcast. A little bit different today. I'm riding solo. Here with me, I have Susan, who is actually a colleague of my mum, and you operate as a
occupational therapist.
Mm-hmm. Out of scope. So we're just going to be talking about a few things. Susan has a bit of an interesting upbringing and interesting background that she'll be sharing with us and some of her experiences. So why don't you introduce yourself?
Oh, well, I'm Susan. I'm an occupational therapist, originally from the UK, as you can tell from my accent. I've been in Australia for about 25 years. Do you want to know anything else?
Yeah. So you currently live out of Horsham?
I actually live in a place called Laharum.
Laharum.
Which is about 30 kilometres south of Horsham. It's in the middle of, it's at the base of the Grampians.
Oh, okay.
And it's 30k north of Halls Gap. So some people might have heard of Halls Gap and the Grampians.
Okay. So is Horsham now, is that considered a major city, would you think? Or is it still very much a country town?
Oh, look, it's a pretty major regional centre, but it wouldn't be as big as, say, Ballarat.
Yeah.
But it's important because it's halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide. So you've got a lot of trucks going up the road.
Oh, okay.
And it's sort of a stopping off spot.
Okay. And so you've been in Melbourne for 25 years or you've been in Australia for 25 years?
I've been in Australia for about 25 years.
Okay.
And I lived in Melbourne. I came to Australia in 92.
Okay.
And stayed in Melbourne until about 2011 and then moved up to the Grampians.
Oh, okay.
And the reason we moved, because in 2006, we took off around Australia. I took a year off work.
Oh, wow.
We took the two young kids.
Yeah.
And we just drove all the way around for 12 months.
Oh, how was that?
It was fantastic. It was really, like, it was great to spend that time with the family.
Of course.
Just that quality of life, really.
Yeah.
And just hanging with each other and having no set agenda. And
of course.
We just gave ourselves a year. But, you know, you might shoot through some places. Other places, you know, you might just stop, say, by a river or whatever for 3 days.
Yeah.
And the kids would build mud castles. They just create, they made a whole load of paints from ochre. And our son, he was 7 at the time, he just devoured the Australian field guide to birds. He just knew every bird.
Oh, wow.
And he'd go, oh, my God, Mum, that's a such and such. And I'm going, how can you tell? And he goes, look at the wingtips. They go up at the end.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm going, where's the bird? I can't even look at the wingtip. So it was just, it was amazing. And we talked to them a lot about conserving resources because we spend a lot of time off-road. We didn't want to go to the van parks.
Okay.
So we go...
Fan park?
Van, as in caravan.
Oh, van
park. Yeah.
Okay.
So whatever water we had, that was it.
Wow.
You know, it's like, you can't waste this water.
Yep.
We've got no more. You know, we're going really, really remote. We actually went up through the middle up to Alice Springs and Uluru. Then we shot across the Great Victorian Desert and went through Docker River and...
oh, wow.
What was it? Warburton and places like that. No, was it Walton? Anyway, I can't remember.
Yeah.
So it was like 300 kilometres of nothing, really. And
how was that? Because, like, for me, growing up in the city or in the suburbs, I can't really imagine just seeing nothing for, like...
yeah.
Like, do you understand? Like, the concept of, like, every day I wake up, I get into my car, there's someone opposite me. There's someone beside me. Like that concept where you wake up and you're literally alone for kilometres. Did you take that in very much or didn't really think about it or?
Well, there's always something to look at. Even looking at like the red roads, you know, going on and on and on. That was really interesting. Or like the really scrubby brush. Or you'd be in the middle of nowhere and suddenly you'd come across this amazing spring. You know, so there was always something to look at. And I don't know, maybe I am sociable, but I'm not as well.
Yeah.
So it was just really nice being out there in the bush with the family. You'd meet people on the road and then you might travel with them for a bit. Or I remember I was in Mount Isa, I think, and started talking to this woman who knew people I knew back home. You know, they're my neighbours back home. So
wow.
You make these incredible connections. And even like, what I think we went to Dukkerjørde, which is a roadhouse in the like middle of nowhere. The kids met up with some Aboriginal kids and they took them out. And the kids were just fascinated because they had a pet kangaroo and they took them up to the jump up and showed them how to catch tadpoles. And, yeah, the kids had a fantastic time.
That's so interesting. Like, you know, as kids, you don't have these sort of boundaries that you develop as an adult. You know, like, as you, some people, as they get a bit older, they're like, oh, I don't want to associate myself with this person because of this feature, or I don't want to associate myself because of that feature. But it is, it's so interesting, even like, you know, when you see these little children and they interact, they just don't know any better. And you just wonder how these sorts of, you know, boundaries develop as you get older.
Well, I suppose it probably comes from the attitudes of the parents a lot of the times. You know, like, my mother's Burmese, my father's English, I'm now living in Australia. You know, the kids come from a multicultural background.
Of course.
And so we've always, people are always people first. Doesn't matter if they're colour, religion, whatever.
Yep.
They're people, you know.
Yep.
And because of the work I do, when I'm looking with people who are nonverbal and they've often got behaviours of concern, you're always trying to work out, what does that behaviour mean? And I think that's really applicable to everyday life. So, you know, like, there might be some road rage going on. Now, instead of getting angry, you might go, I wonder what's happened for that person that day. You know, has somebody died, or have they, you know...
Bad day at work,
or they just might be really, really stressed or depressed and something's happened. There's always a reason for people doing what they do. And I just think people do the best that they can with the resources they've got at that point in time.
Of course.
Yeah. So it's not about... It's not condoning behaviour, but it's actually trying to see where it comes from.
So so it's more about trying to understand that, you know, we all have our good and bad days.
That's right.
I guess the issue is that in those kinds of instances where it's like something like road rage, or, you know, you might, someone might not say thank you if you open a door, you only see or interact with that person for that moment. You're not there with them to the hours before where they actually went from a really good mood to a really bad mood. You weren't there when they actually experienced something that made them act that way. So your point of view, where you're trying to think of, oh, you know, give them the... It's kind of like a very Australian benefit of the doubt sort of thing, where you go, you know what, I'm sure he's having a bad day. Hopefully it gets better, sort of thing. But,
Or you don't know, like, you know, when I was at uni, afterwards people used to say to me, oh, you're so rude, you never acknowledged me when I waved. And I'm going, what do you mean you waved? I never saw you, because I'm very, very short-sighted.
Okay. Right?
And I've also got what they call a sensory missing profile, where I'm just kind of not really aware of my surroundings. I probably didn't even notice that you walked past me.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, so that could, that you could then be construed as being really rude, but actually you just didn't notice them.
And I suppose, like, you know, when you, because my mum's a speech pathologist and she's in the same field of, you know, speech pathology. It's obviously you're from a different perspective, but the kind of clientele you work with are very similar. So I suppose that being exposed to people who really don't have control over their senses really, not exposes you, but really opens your eyes to, you know, the fact that we also go through probably not the same sorts of experiences them, but we have times where we just out and we just don't, like, we don't hear you, we don't see you. But talking, going back towards children, let's talk a little bit about your childhood in England.
Okay.
In the motherland.
Back in England. We actually moved around a lot because my dad was in the Air Force. So I moved every 3 years of my life.
That would have been very difficult back then.
Yeah, you sort of get used to it. But I suppose the thing that really struck me was that when my mum came to the UK, she arrived in her Halonji, you know, from Burma, knew a bit of English, but really came to this foreign land. And then she met my father, and that would have been in the late 50s.
So at that time, what was the situation in Burma? Because obviously at the moment, there's a bit of, turmoil, there's a bit of issues in the country. Was it the same sort of situation back then?
It was different issues back then, because when mum came, as I said, the end of the 50s, and she was sponsored to train as a nurse. And then whilst she was here, she met my father, and she took out British citizenship because he was in the Air Force. Now, in that time, General Ne Win took over and it became a military dictatorship.
Oh, wow.
So she actually never had the opportunity to go back home because she changed her nationality to British. They said, you clearly don't want to be Burmese, you can't go back. All right. eventually she managed to give up that years and years later. But basically it was a military dictatorship.
Okay.
So when Mum came to the UK again, there was a bit of racism. And so she really wanted us to assimilate and be British kids. So she didn't teach us the language and the culture or anything like that, which I think probably in this day and age would be different because it's much more about accepting your culture. Us girls, we were fine, but my brother got picked on a lot. You know, it's like chinky, chinky, go home and all this ridiculousness. And my mum would just get incensed because she'd go, we're not even Chinese. This is so ignorant.
I was actually having this discussion at work today with my boss, who's from Afghanistan. And he was saying that, you know, Iranians are like this. And I was thinking that for someone like myself, to be quite frank, I can't really tell the difference between someone who's from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, because they have very similar facial, they have a very similar look. You know, the language obviously varies, but if I don't, if I can't speak like Pashtun or Farsi, then I couldn't be able to differentiate. Mm. So it's very interesting to see that, you know, we just blanket people who have similar sorts of looks or speak a similar sort of language. And so how do you, so you didn't really face much of this because you're quite, you didn't really take on much of the Asian characteristics.
Well, and also I think in some ways girls are seen as a bit more exotic and it's interesting. Do you know what I mean? Whereas that's how I felt. I mean, I don't look as Burmese as the as my sisters, but they didn't have the same sort of issues anyway. It was just like, oh, you look a bit interesting. And whereas for the boy, I don't know, like just for the boys, it seemed to be different. And much, much more about it being a negative thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose in some ways it's a bit like, I don't know, like, you know, those mixed race women are seen to be quite interesting, I suppose.
Halfies.
Yeah, well, the Eurasians, you know, it's kind of, it's valued more. And I think that's, you know, in our society, like, beauty is valued. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're not, you're not looking at the person, but you're looking at this kind of this external appearance. Oh,
okay, so you can't. So I mean, like, you know, obviously it's a very shallow approach. Mm. But so you feel that maybe that's because the reason why you and your sisters weren't as bullied because they were like, oh, not your typical white girl. You're a little bit good looking. So whereabouts in England? So you moved around. So where did you start off and where did you end up?
Well, I was born in Muswell Hill, which is North London.
And
when I was two, we moved to Singapore
for
2 or 3 years.
Okay.
And then we came back to the UK. And then in the England, you do O-levels and A-levels. And at 16, you do your O-levels.
Yep.
And then, so my father was posted to Germany, or he knew he was going to be going at that time in the middle of my O-levels. So I actually was sent off to boarding school and I stayed in the UK when the rest of them went to Germany.
How was that?
Well, at the time, I just didn't really question it. That's just what happened. However, I was an incredibly shy child. And I think the first few weeks or months, I don't know, I find it quite difficult. I got very, very homesick. And I remember, like, waking up and you'd hear vacuum cleaners going. I think, oh, I'm home. I'm like, oh, no, I'm at school. I don't know. I don't think I enjoyed it. But then I read a lot. I spent a lot of time just reading and I was in my own world, and stuff like that. I don't know, just survived it. Didn't have a bad time. I wasn't bullied or anything like that.
Oh, wow.
But I wasn't really good at sport and...
So you didn't really stand out in that aspect? No, just kind of did your own thing?
Yeah, and I was a pretty average student, I reckon. And then I went to uni and... I remember the headmistress when I left, she basically said it's a good job I was going on to uni because I was basically finally getting it. You know, so I must have been a really late developer or something.
Oh, wow.
So, so then I stayed in the UK. I did a secretarial course when I left school, because I left school at 17 and an all-girls school and I didn't want to go straight to uni. So I went to a tech college for a year. Then I went and studied geography because I was interested in it and what you do. Did that. Don't know what to do geography, so I then studied, I did a master's in town planning and I did third world town planning.
Oh, wow.
So I did my master's thesis on low cost housing solutions in Asia.
Do you still remember much of that thesis?
A little bit. I mean, it was all about sites and services, so making sure that people were safe, because often people just like hook into like electricity lines, you know, and it could be very unsafe, lots of fires.
Yeah.
And issues with sewerage and rubbish. And so if you can get the basic infrastructure there, it's much more healthy.
Oh, okay.
So, and then I kind of, and I travelled and eventually came back from travel, and I worked at a day service for people with disabilities.
Okay.
And I was going, oh, what's wrong with that person? What's wrong, you know, and people were talking to me about different, you know, whether the person had autism or Down syndrome or whatever. And they're saying, why don't you go and train and be an OT? And I said, what's one of them? And so then I found about OT, and I was sponsored by the hospital to go and be an OT. And so eventually I did that and started work. I was about 30, like full-time work with a career, whereas up to then I'd kind of done odd jobs and done different courses.
Yeah, of course. It
took me a long time to...
How do you think, I mean, obviously initially you came from a multiracial background, but how do you think your experiences abroad, you know, visiting different places kind of helped you? Do you think it made you more accepting, or you were already at a point where you were very accepting as a person?
I think I was always very accepting because I'd come from a multi... cultural family. And it was interesting because when I was at uni, there was apartheid in South Africa. And I remember having a discussion with one of my friends who is Anglo-Indian. And we were saying if we'd been in South Africa, we could not have been friends with our friends.
Of course, because
Of the colour.
Yeah.
You know? So I was, you know, very sort of joined anti-apartheid movements and things like that. And you can't, how can you be racist when you're mixed blood anyway? Like, you have to, like,
You can't really pick a side, can you?
Exactly. So, to me, people are people.
So, in terms of, like, apartheid, what was the, I suppose you can only talk from your experiences, what was the general view of what was happening in South Africa at that time? Like, was there a consensus that what they were doing was wrong, or were there some people who were for it and some people against it? Like,
look, I think you're going to get that anywhere you go, but in the circles that I moved in, obviously, we were all anti-apartheid.
Yeah.
So, and that's the thing, you tend to, don't you? You tend to make friends with people with similar views. But I'm sure there would have been some people who were for it, I don't know.
Of course, yeah.
But not people I knew.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, we actually, like, our family personally know a few people from South Africa, and I've read the Nelson Mandela biography, and just the thought of having to check in, you know, you have a curfew, you know, having so many of your basic rights taken away from you.
Oh, look, when I was at uni, we had Donald Woods come and talk to us. So, and he was a journalist in South Africa, and he was a really good friend with Steve Biko, who was on Robben Island. So it was
the prison.
Yeah. Oh, and and one of the guys who came to talk, he'd been on Robben Island as well. And that whole, that structure even within prison, you know, you had that, who was on the bottom of the heap.
And, yeah, of course.
But, you know, I suppose it was a time, I think I went to uni at a really good time. Like, it was free education. It wasn't just about having to get your degree. It was about life. I was a member of a women's group as well, and women's issues were important. Member of Third World First. You know, like, you could just delve into all those different political and social things and not just think about getting a job at the end.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me personally, being at university, I think that, you know, they try to facilitate a lot of these sorts of initiatives. So, you know, you can join at Swinburne, you can join the Swinburne Union. There's another group called Swinburne Life, Student Life, where they have different kinds of groups. And there's a lot of international groups who, like, for example, there's, like, the Indian group, the Sri Lankan group. So I think, you know, as much as the shift has been now towards go to uni, get my degree, get a job, there's also a lot of, you know, there's also a lot of opportunity for you to get yourself out there and experience different, you know, speak to people from different cultures, experience a new group.
That's great.
It's just more about whether or not people are interested enough to partake in those sorts of activities, which I guess will always be the great debate, whereas, you know, universities, they do supply these sorts of networking and, you know, volunteering opportunities. It really just comes down to students are willing to, you know, put the time and effort in to do it.
Okay, so it's not like you feel, oh my gosh, I've got this massive hex debt, I've got to just focus on my studies.
No, I mean, like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this has been a shift from, you know, you get a degree, you get a job, to you get a degree, you don't know if you're going to get a job.
Right.
You know, so like for someone like myself, like, you know, there's over the next 3 to 5 years, there's probably going to be a huge amount of people graduating university with similar sorts of the same sort of major. It's just what now is the importance is whether or not you're willing to do extracurricular activities, you know, and get yourself out there, get involved, network, and get involved in these sorts of things so that you can, you know, have some real life experience while you're getting the technical knowledge.
But I also think like there's got to be a shift because I was listening to an article this morning from a guy called Martin Seligman who talks about PERMA, and it's about positive psychology and looking at your mental and emotional health.
Yeah.
And that actually helps you do better academically as well. You know, there's been so much focus recently on getting, you've got to get this particular ATAR score and, you know, this kind of push to kids to achieve and it's just not good for their mental health.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was watching a TED Talk.
Oh yeah.
About self motivation, and you know he brought up a number of good points, but one of them was, are you a success seeker or a failure avoider?
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's yeah, right. It's very simple, but when you think about it, am I going to class because I don't want to fail?
Yeah.
Or am I going to class because I want to succeed?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. For me, I think education is all about that thirst for knowledge, you know, wanting to learn.
Exactly.
And but I think that kind of really gets whipped out of kids sometimes in secondary school because there's so much focus on you have to meet these, you know, this curriculum, and teachers can't be creative.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's trying to find the balance between being competitive. Because I mean, like if you look at countries like Singapore or, you know, a lot of Southeast Asian countries, the education system is much, much more intense. And it's a lot higher standard as opposed to ours. So how does the, you know, education stay fun and, you know, creative when we're trying to catch up to these other countries who are, you know, because at the end of the day, Singapore is a country of 5 million. I think around about 5 million. And they have the same, you know, economic dollar as us.
What's the mental health like though?
Of course.
Do you know what I mean? You know,
quality of life is another aspect.
Exactly.
Which is why a lot of people leave countries like that to come here.
And there's a lot of pressure. I mean, I think the kids started doing public exams at the age of 3. You know, a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it can't be good for your mental health.
No, of course not. For me, I think that, you know, growing up in Australia, you get a lot more freedom to decide. You know, in primary school, you choose your friends. You know, you kind of get a lot more interaction, you get a lot more people skills as opposed to being strictly book smart.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the way that the world's moving in terms of technology taking up more and more jobs, technical skills are important, but soft skills, empathy, problem solving, teamwork are becoming much more important. So do we continue to move more towards drilling our children or drilling people my age with technical knowledge, or do we shift and focus on how do we make these people more soft skilled orientated so that when they get into the workforce they're able to take criticism, work in a team, things like that? I guess it's kind of like the dilemma.
I think you're going to succeed in life if you've got good emotional intelligence,
EQ,
yeah, rather than just being academically smart, you know, because there's just, because you're going to always have situations where things don't go your way or you're going to get frustrated, and you just need to learn to deal with that. You know, or you do get your own rage and everything because people get frustrated and they can't get somewhere in a hurry, and then they kind of, they just, their arousal just goes through the roof.
Yeah. I mean, from your point of view in your industry, where it's obviously there has to be a substantial level of technical understanding of, you know, people with disabilities and what are some of the pointers and things like that. How do you find that your emotional intelligence weighs against your actual knowledge in terms of importance? Do you find that it's more important for you to have a better overview of the emotional aspect and understanding them as a person, or looking for, you know, different markers as to what they're, maybe they're, not their issue, but what's causing them to be in that situation?
Look, I think it's actually a mixture of the two, because you need to use your clinical skills to assess what's going on. But if you're looking at intervention, you actually need to have good social skills, because a person doesn't exist on their own. They exist within the context of a home or a school or a day service or whatever. And I'm not going to ever go in as a professional and say, I know best and you've got to do this, this and this, because that's not going to get anything done. So what you actually have to do is to be really good work with a team, being able to present your ideas in a way that is acceptable to other people, you know, looking at what their skills are like and what their interests are like. So you go, oh, that's a good idea. Let's expand on that. And in that way, you can help the person you're trying to support. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so as much as you want to get you want to ensure people have soft skills, they also need to be at a level where they understand their occupation and they understand the technical knowledge that goes along with it.
You're doing a lot of teaching, I suppose, with staff to help them to understand, but I can't go barging in as a therapist and go, you have to do it like this, I'm the expert, da 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 da. That's where your kind of emotional skills are important and your social skills to basically, how do you get everybody else on board to work with you, yeah. Right? The other thing is you have to know that sometimes things will not go well, and some people can be quite idealistic when they first start out and we're going to change the world, and that ain't going to happen, you know? So you just look for those incremental changes, mm-hmm. and you celebrate the successes.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it can get you down.
Of course.
And I think that's where you use your kind of your emotional intelligence. And sometimes it can be frustrating, but you try and see things from other people's point of view as well. You know, the staff, they might be really stressed themselves. They're traumatized, yeah. because some of the behaviors, they might not be, yeah. They often have quite low pay, things like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's answered your question. You know, I think you need both, yeah. really.
No, that's right. Do you find that there's certain, you know, obviously you work with a variety of people from different backgrounds. Do you find that some cultures deal with, you know, children with disabilities better than others, or some are not very accepting of the fact that their child actually has some sort of disability? Do you find that very much at all, or is it very much just people only care about the interests of their child?
Well, I see sort of the child of the person within the family and also within organisations, because they've been relinquished. So I suppose that can be a difference. Like if it's your child, you're much more invested in, say, maybe the therapy, whereas in an organisation, maybe people are just trying to survive and get through the day. But in terms of different attitudes to disability, I mean, there probably are cultural differences, but I haven't really come across that, I don't think. I think it's, yeah, because... No, I don't think I have come across that, really.
Mm.
I think what differences you can see, it's not so much just with disability, but like, you know, I said I'd moved to the country, and what I found there is sometimes people maybe have... How do I say this?
What you want to say.
Yeah. Well, for example, my daughter came home one day and she goes, oh my gosh, Mom, there was a boy on the bus and he was talking about coons. And she goes, that is awful. Coons. Like, which is a really derogatory term, I think, for Aboriginal people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, I find it terrible because you've got coon cheese here. But in England, that is just a shocking derogatory term for a black person.
Oh, so it's actually an English term.
Yeah, but I think it must be used in Australia as well, because these kids were Australian.
Okay.
You know, and then you have these people talking about the Abos. And I was just appalled.
Yeah.
And you have to find... You just meet a person. And I felt I couldn't... When I first moved up there, you can't say, how dare you use that sort of language, you know, but you kind of get to know people and then you go, oh, really, you know, oh, you mean, you know, Aboriginal people or whatever, and you just try and change the conversation a bit. And I think I've realised that some of the people I've seen, they're not mean, horrible people, but they just haven't been exposed to different ideas.
Because, I mean, for myself, you know, this is actually one of the topics I want to talk about, was the difference between city and country living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously in the country you're more, I could be wrong here, but you're more likely to run into Aboriginal people?
No, not so much. No, it depends what parts of the country you are. So you're not necessarily. What I find particularly in this area we're at, it's very white bread. So my kids, who are only a quarter Asian, are known as the Asians.
Oh, wow.
isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah.
You know, because there's so few, there's not much diversity.
Okay.
Hmm.
Wow. So, I mean, you were talking before that the your current city or region is actually taking in a lot of refugees.
Yeah, yeah. So there's an area called Nil, and there's a lot of Karen refugees there. So the Karen, Burmese Karen, the Karen are in Burma and Thailand. And I can't even remember how it started, but anyway, once some people go to an area, other people go to the area because, you know, they know people the same.
Of course, it could be like, you know my aunt who lives in this village.
Yeah.
Because that's actually something we find in Singapore that because of the lack of regulations around maids and servants, you actually have a lot of people coming from Indonesia, Philippines, India, who come on very, very low wages, and they'll actually work as maids or servants. Or so, for example, pretty much all of the civil work done in Singapore is done from people from overseas.
Okay.
And they're on very low pay. But what really fascinated me was one day we were walking at a local, at one of the train stations called Geylang, which is near where my auntie lives, and all these people who were obviously not from Singapore, were just hanging out at a train station. And you saw all these, like this group of Indians hanging with all the Indians and these Indonesians. And I just found it fascinating that these people, you know, they come to Singapore and they'll meet someone and be like, oh, you know my so-and-so from here. And it's just amazing how these people can make connections. Like, it wouldn't even have to be from the same village. It could be the next village over or whatnot. But, yeah, that's very interesting.
Well, it's the same because my dad lives in Hong Kong. And so it's the same there. You know, it's a lot of Filipino maids. But one person I know, she was actually an optometrist back in the Philippines, but she could make more money being a maid in Hong Kong.
Wow. And unfortunately, the issue is with that sort of system, the rights of these people in these conditions are not taken care of very well.
Oh, no. There's been some horrendous... Because I was talking to my dad's, I suppose, got a maid. And
How do you feel about that?
I find it difficult. Because in Australia and England, it isn't really the cultural norm. However, I know, like, when we lived in Singapore, we had an armour. And she...
A what?
They were called armours. Armour. This was back in the 1960s.
Okay.
So I suppose the armour was the live-in maid, and she would look after the children, mainly looking after the children. I don't know. I mean, I was only two, so I don't really know. But I get the sense that it was looking after children more than sort of the housework. And I remember apparently there's this story one time my father wanted to discipline us, and the armour took us kids and locked us in the bathroom and wouldn't come out. Despite my father saying, if you don't come out now, you'll be sacked, and yes, master or sir, or whatever they said. And then he eventually calmed down and she brought us out.
So
that was really nice, having somebody to help look after you. But I just, when I go to Hong Kong, or my dad's got a flat in Penang now as well, and there's the maid's quarters, and you look and you think, oh my God, it's like this little room under the stairs or something, and you've got this massive house with these big rooms. I'm actually quite challenged by it.
Yeah.
But then when one of the ladies was saying, I earn more money than being in the Philippines, I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, you've got a job, I suppose. But I just don't like that inequality. I've been a socialist from very, very young.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, because the issue for me is that there's no one protecting, like, they have agencies and whatnot. And, you know, when there's issues in a household, it's very he said, she said. There's not a whole lot of evidence. And obviously you have people on both sides who are trying to abuse the system, like you have maids who are doing the wrong thing. But the difference that kind of affects me the most is, If I have a bad experience with a maid, I can send her back and get another one. It's like, for every maid trying to work in Singapore, there's five or six in her home country who are willing to do the exact same job. Because, like you said, the pay's better. You know, it's...
But there's so much... It's really interesting, actually, because my dad's... I hate the term maid. I don't know.
Helper
or whatever. She was saying that there's apparently the Chinese employers are the worst and they treat them the worst. This is what she was saying. So this is all hearsay.
Yeah.
But there was some situation she was telling us about where one made, I think the husband just got incensed because she'd taken some food and which wasn't meant to be hers or something, and she paid it back. And it was like a fishbowl, and he had created this whole great big saga about you taking one of my fishbowls. And she paid him back, and then I think he still sacked her or something happened. And I think there was a case about that as well.
Yeah.
So maybe there are a few more rights. But I just think, how can you treat another person like that?
Here's the thing. Here's my opinion that just like technology exposes us, so does being in a position of power.
Oh, yeah.
You're in a position of power, once someone gets that power, they're either going to continue on their merry way and be the same sort of person, or they're going to abuse the power.
Mm. And it's interesting because even though we've had maids when my mum was there, the maids would come and sit with us when we ate. You know, like they weren't treated as second-class citizens, you're just part of the family and... well, not really part of, but you know, you'd sit with the family and have a chat. You weren't sort of sent off to a little hovel somewhere to eat your dinner, and you know, and it wasn't about, oh, this is our food, that's your food. It's like, just, you know, help yourself.
Yeah, I mean, like my experience, you know, you have some people who are very welcoming, but I know that the people who aren't as welcoming is because it comes from a place of fear, because you know, again, absolutely. And this is the issue, you know. Although you do have agencies in Singapore, you have a lot of people who are coming from villages and things like that. And, you know, it's very hard for, once that trust is broken with one maid, you know, this family will talk to this family. Oh my God, my maid was the worst. You know, she did this, 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 and this. So then now you're hearing the bad side of what maids do. And it's perfectly normal for people to go on the scared or the defensive when they don't actually experience it for themselves.
Mm. Well, we fear the unknown, don't we?
Exactly. Because
it's potentially threatening, so you kind of, it puts you into fight flight. But it reminds me of my work as well. People get a reputation, you know, oh, that person's aggressive or that person's a biter or whatever, and they completely forget the person. They just become the behaviour. So a lot of work that...
How do you think that happens, that you throw, for example, instead of saying Johnny bites, it's the biter?
Mm. You know, oh no, but it's disgusting because you're demonising the person with their behaviour and you're forgetting the person there, and you're actually forgetting that little Johnny probably can't even talk.
Yeah.
So how else does he express frustration or his needs or whatever?
Yeah. So, and I guess that's, if you kind of compare that to, you know, people of different cultures, like chinky chinky go home. You know,
mind you, he did get called chicken legs as well because he had really bad eczema. So my poor brother had a really hard time.
I hope he's going all right now. fair enough. Yeah, no, we'll leave it at that. I think that's a conversation. Okay. That's good. Okay. But you know, it's like turning around and calling someone an abo.
Yeah, I know.
Because the issue is the word abo itself. You know, even myself, like, you know, I remember a few years, it was the big outrage when Dipper said it.
Oh, okay.
He slipped out, and he, you know, obviously he's very apologetic, but it's, you know, it's all of the words and all the feelings and attributes that are associated with that word. And you demonize a person, not for what he's done to you, what he's done to your family, or what he's done in society. It's literally just his ethnicity.
Yeah, I know. And actually, that reminds me, when I first came to Australia, I was appalled because I thought, people come from all different countries. They must be, you know, really multicultural and really accepting. And I was sat in the car waiting. A friend of mine had gone into a shop. And I saw these, I reckon they were primary school kids, and they're walking behind a Chinese man and doing mock Chinese, you know, language, basically being really disrespectful.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it. And anyway, they stopped near me and ran down the window and go, "What do you think you're doing?" I said, "You know, what you're doing is really, really disrespectful." And anyway, I started talking to these kids, and basically they said, "Well, they don't like us and we don't like them."
When was this?
This would have probably been about 92, 93.
That was the romper stomper age, wasn't it?
Probably. I can't really remember.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've heard of it vaguely, but I remember because, I don't know if that was that was probably, there was a very, I think towards the late, I could be wrong here, I think the 80s was when there was a massive influx of people from Southeast Asia because of, it might have been a little bit earlier, but there was at the time when there was this massive influx of Asians coming from Southeast Asia because due to the situations over there. And it just comes back to the fear of the unknown.
Well, exactly right, because then they started talking to me and I said, hang on a minute, I'm Asian, I'm part Asian, you're talking to me. And they go, yeah, but you don't look it. And I thought, oh my God, how ignorant are you? But you can't blame the kids in a way either. You know, it's like, what are the messages they're getting at home as well? And maybe in their, I don't know, their schoolyard.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it comes from your attitudes at home. You're going to pick up the attitudes of your parents, aren't you?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you're a parent as well. And your upbringing was very different to your children's because you were probably exposed to, not to say two extremes, but two very different cultures. From, you know, your mum being Burmese and your dad being English. So you kind of got an understanding of multiculturalism from a young age. Now you've kind of gone more, you know, obviously I don't know your day to day, but you have a very English accent.
Oh, do I?
Well,
when I phone home, people tell me I have an Aussie slang, Aussie twang now or something.
Yeah, of course. But how do you kind of instill to your children that kind of acceptance, considering that they're kind of, now instead of being half or a quarter?
Well, I don't know. I suppose we've always talked about treating people as you'd want to be treated yourself. It's not a person is a person. It's not about their colour or their race or whatever. I talk a lot about the injustices of the world and, you know, how people with maybe refugees are treated or homeless or whatever. And it was quite interesting because the kids' school, they in year 11, they go on a retreat. And they went off and they met a refugee, an Aboriginal person, a homeless person. And at the end of the retreat, the kids had to write up or do a presentation. And apparently so many of them are in tears because they had only read about refugee. They hadn't understood, you know, why somebody might be a refugee or why somebody might be homeless or whatever. And anyway, apparently there's loads of tears and my son wasn't crying. I said, how come? Do you have no empathy? He goes, Mom, I know it. We talk about it all the time. It's not new.
See, that's the thing. I'd assume that would be the norm. It's not like you accept everyone except blacks, Indians, Chinese. You know, like I'd assume, like for me, you know, like my dad's brown. You know, you can't anyway look at it, he's brown. You know, he's a wonderful man. He's been a great father. My mum's white, borderline opaque. But you know, like it's so I've had a contrast from an early age.
Yeah.
So like. And, you know, at the end of the day, you can very easily look at a person's colour and attribute your personal feelings towards that race, or you can see that person for a person. And I think that the issue is that we're so used to, because we actually spoke to one of my tutors who's a socioeconomic analysis, so she's doing a PhD in that. She's saying we compartmentalise everything. So, like, for example, we have an experience with an Indian, and this is how all Indians are. You have an experience with a Chinese person. This is all China. It's like because of the how many things we have going on in our mind, we just attribute one experience to that whole race.
Oh no! Well, I find that really difficult to, because to me it's about that interaction you have with that person.
Of course.
You know, like, and it doesn't matter whether they're black, brown, blue, or yellow. You know, yeah, exactly. What I mean?
I agree.
But I don't know. I mean, I suppose I've just talked to the kids a lot about social justice and accepting people. And I try and work a lot on their emotional resilience. You know, it's not just about learning your ABCs. It's about how you cope with life, how you cope with frustration, you know, how you treat other people. I mean, my daughters, I mean, they're really good because they do accept everybody. And she's actually, when she's been at the bus transfer station and she's seen people picking on somebody, maybe because they have a disability or whatever, she will intervene. And it was interesting because there was an article in the paper recently about somebody had done a fantastic job because they'd spent some time with this girl who had Down syndrome. And, you know, Hannah knows the girl and she goes, oh, God, it must be really awful for people to pick up that. Isn't it great they hang with her because she's got Down syndrome? Do you know what I mean? Like, she's just a person. Like, why do you have to be, you know, given all this accolade because you kind of interact with her?
Okay, for me, there's two points of view looking at it. There's one point of view where you, that point of view where you look at her as a person, or you can look at it the other way as an example for other people to take up the mantle and do those kinds of activities.
Well, yes.
So
I suppose that's what they were trying to do, but from her perspective, she was seeing the person and is going, you know, you just treat her the same as everybody else. What's the big deal?
That's very interesting because it's kind of like she's a little bit against the grain in that aspect then, because she's very much aware that these, you know, and I try to be very careful the way I describe, you know, people with disabilities, because obviously, you know, like the exposure I've had with mum and, you know, I've met some, I've actually met some of her clients and the people she's worked with. So, you know, the fact that your daughter's already able to distinguish the fact that, what do you mean? She's just, it's just like that's hanging just out with a mate.
Exactly.
She's
right.
Just a mate.
Exactly right.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, but isn't that great though, just to accept the person as the person, not
of course.
Not for their disability or their colour or their
yep.
religion or whatever.
Yep. All right, so now it's time for the best segment of the show, Fire in the Pock. Fire in the Pock.
What is that?
So recently there was a you're gonna have to ask your children to show you Big Man Shaq.
Big Man Shaq?
Yeah, I'm sure he's kind of gone off the scene a little bit, but
you can obviously tell my age here, can't you? Yeah, I've got no idea what you're talking about.
That's all right. Well, it's just gonna be some quick fire questions that you're gonna have to answer.
Oh golly.
Okay. Okay? All right. Summer or winter?
It's very difficult because
that's why it's called Fire in the Pock. Because you're under fire.
I know, but you know what? Because I keep saying, oh, we're coming into spring. And then I go, oh, no, we're not. We're coming into winter. Because I'm from the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean?
Of course.
So I couldn't do that. I had to think about that one.
All right.
Try the one.
Okay, so we'll come back to that one then. Melbourne or Horsham? Or
Laharum.
Laharum, that's right.
Laharum is actually very different to Horsham.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
In terms of, like, the size or the kind of people that live there?
Besides, like where we are, there's a lot of people who used to live in the city who've retired or moved up there as teachers, so they're professionals.
Okay.
And I love Laharum, but I wouldn't want to live in Horsham because also Laharum, you're just out there in nature.
Okay.
So that's not a very quick fire question, is it? Sorry.
No, that's all right. Look, this is what usually happens, anyways. Dogs or cats?
Both.
I'm not gonna lie, you're not very good at this, but that's all right. Indian or Chinese food?
Indian.
Okay. Vegemite, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah. I don't like Marmite, actually, which is English. I prefer the Vegemite, which is Australian.
Yeah, no, it can't be a Vegemite. All right, Sue, thank you very much for coming on. I know it was a little bit short notice and I kind of sprung it on you.
Yes.
But thank you for answering my questions. Do you want to plug your books? Do you want to tell people about your books?
No.
No, that's all right. All right, guys. So, Facebook, People of Colour podcast, Instagram podcast. Thank you for listening. Take it easy. Goodbye.